Tim, did you want to introduce our guest?
Sure.
And I'm sorry, this is for item 13 presentation from Sit Investment Associates. Go ahead.
Thanks. Every time we do one of the functional sub-portfolio reviews, I like to bring in either a manager or a couple of managers to talk about a theme in the portfolio. So today I'm joined by Bryce Doty, who heads the fixed income division of Sit Investments. He is our portfolio manager. I think, Bryce, you've been there for, I believe, decades is the correct terminology at this point.
Yes, it is.
But he's a longstanding member of this team and now leads it, as is our portfolio manager here. So I think I highlighted the process, what makes them a little bit more unique vis-a-vis some of the other managers here. But certainly, Bryce, thank you for joining us today. And he's going to step through a little bit of review of the portfolio, what it does for Contra Costa. And Bryce is also an acute observer of the Fed, and I know wanted to offer some thoughts on the Federal Reserve's impact on the fixed income market as well. So with that, Bryce, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thank you, Tim, and thank you to the whole group for allowing me the opportunity to present to you again. We very much value our relationship with you, and it's an honor to be able to help you achieve your investment goals by managing this particular portfolio. I'm going to, if we can go to the next page, I'll show you that I'm going to focus on a little introduction of myself and the firm, but then quickly move into the specifics of the portfolio. And lastly, cover the outlook for the economy while spending, focusing really on what the Fed has done and what that impact has been on the bond market and what we think will happen going forward, knowing that there is a lot of uncertainty, so there's no guarantee as to what goes forward, but at least, give you our 2 cents worth. So with that, let's jump into the introduction, which is actually starts on page 4. The firm has been around for 39 years, not quite 40 years yet. Our gross assets are about $13 billion. As Tim mentioned, I've been there a while. I've been there for 24 years. My team manages that dark green sliver of the pie, the taxable fixed income portfolio, of which was a tiny sliver when I started and a team of one. So we've come a long ways, added significant products across the board, both on the equity side, the municipal fixed income side, and the taxable fixed income side. We have a wide array of products as well as a wide array of clients. But if you look down the lower left, you can see 72% of the assets are managed in significant institutional, separately managed portfolios like yourself. Moving to page 5, we have a variety of your core traditional stock and bond products. And then we also have at the bottom of the page some unique alternative strategies as well. So we've branched out from our core roots of just being a very, very conservative short duration or intermediate duration bond manager into a broad-based fixed income manager. And then the firm was originally just a growth equity firm the first 3 years. So we've really, come a long ways, but we do it in a very slow, methodical pattern. We're not great marketers. we like managing money. We're not as big on, go growth of assets. And if you look at the next page, page 6, you can see we've got a nice team. We've got a big team. We can manage a lot of money with the group that we have. So we definitely have capacity, and we have the ability to add as needed. The SIT family that founded the firm has retained 30 to 35% of the earnings every single year, and invested those earnings over time. So there's a lot of assets available during the financial crisis. We were hiring people and adding systems and all sorts of things when everyone else was kind of struggling and maybe having to cut expenses and whatnot. We were able to actually expand because of that. Going to the next page, and I'll touch some more on the people in just a little bit. Like right here, if you look at years of investment experience, these are the people primarily invested in the fixed income, with the exception of Roger at the top. He's really a go-go growth equity guy and leaves the day-to-day management of the bond investing for us, even though he has the final say on everything at the end of the day. But again, myself, I have 29 years of experience, 24 of those with SIT Investments. So I remember when I joined as a much younger man thinking I'd be there for like 3 years or 5 years and get a track record and kind of move on. And here I am 24 years later, still at the firm and really, really happy with my decision to do that. It's a great firm, and you can see the years with SIA, with SIT Investment Associates on the far right, you know, people don't tend to leave much. I think part of that is because the firm has a long-term perspective, so there isn't this quarter-by-quarter, what have you done for me lately kind of mentality. You know, we want to win the war and have a long-term view of getting through investment cycles while being tactically opportunistic along the way. Jump in with questions if you have any. Let's move to page 8. In the lower right is the growth in assets of the fixed income. As I mentioned, we have good products, we have good returns, we just don't have a big, huge sales effort. For most of the 24 years I was at the firm, we had one salesperson for bonds for the whole country. So you kind of had to find us. You know, we were the quiet company, I guess. But it's great because it's very managed growth for us and makes it easy. Let's move to page 9. Our focus is trying to get more income than the benchmark. So the squares are at the top, and the dashed lines link the squares, which are our strategies, to the corresponding benchmark. And the way we pick up income is usually by how a bond is structured. So it might be callable, there might be prepayments with mortgages. We typically do not go down into low quality type bonds. We don't really have much of a junk bond presence even. But we do get into the very nitty gritty details of the structure of a bond in order to be able to find ways to get incrementally more yield without giving up quality. And you'll see how that really has played out well for your portfolio. We can move to the next page, page 10. This section is on the portfolio, but before I go further, are there any questions about my background or the team's background or the firm?
Any trustee questions? Doesn't appear so. Please continue.
Okay, great. Let's go to page 11. Now this is a bit of an overview of how we stack up to the benchmark and what the yield and quality of the portfolio is right now. If you begin by focusing on this box, box down below, the yield average life is 1.7. The 1 to 3 year government bond index is 0.2. You know, the Fed is really just taking the treasury yields down to nothing. Most of our clients that hire us for short duration are trying to beat the 1 to 3 year government bond index. So it's very, very common that we are given that as the benchmark to beat. It's not because we invest in treasuries, it's because that's what our clients' policies state within their plans or within their endowments or whatever it might be. Their goal is to find a manager that can consistently beat the 1 to 3 year government. But we don't buy treasuries. As you can see in the other two graphs on the page, we are primarily buying mortgage securities. On the right-hand side, they are all federal agency guaranteed. So if there's a default on a mortgage, you're paid by a government agency such as Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, or Ginnie Mae. The duration down at the very bottom is a bit longer than the index, which is a positive for the portfolio. And I'll go into detail later as to why that is. It's a nature of the fact that these prepayments that we're getting in on the mortgages have slowed. And the fact that we have very high coupon pass-throughs, that's great because we get to keep that coupon longer. So that has been a nice benefit for the portfolio. But I'll touch a base on that in a little bit. Let's go to page 12. So here on the top of the page shows the sector weightings in the portfolios and their pass-throughs and CMOs. I do want to make a point that most of the CMOs are just like mortgage pass-throughs. So a CMO, the difference between a pass-through and a CMO is the CMOs takes a big, huge pool of mortgages and it cuts them up into different slices and they'll pay off at different times. Whereas the mortgage pass-throughs, 10% of the loans refinance. That 10% of principal that came back gets divvied up pro rata amongst the investors. With CMOs, there's a priority of payment. Whoever's in that first slice will get all of the principal first before anyone else gets it. Well, by the time we buy a CMO, most of the people have refinanced. So all those slices are gone except for like the last one. And it basically behaves just like a pass-through at that point. So I just want to make the point to just think of this as just these are all big pools of high coupon mortgages where we're at a portion of whatever principal payments are coming in, as well as a pro rata portion of the interest payments coming in. At the very bottom, you can see the yield has compared, you know, pretty well versus the 1-3 year government. For the most part, we've been able to get more income than the corresponding 1-3 year government because you are taking prepayment risk. Even though you're not taking credit risk, there's uncertainty as to when people are going to refinance their mortgages or pay them off, if they're going to move or whatnot. And that's why you earn the extra interest. Flip to page 13. This is, I think, an easier way to see the yield advantage. So the green line, the top line, represents the yield for your portfolio. The blue represents the yield for the underlying treasury index. And you can see just on the lower right how low treasury yields. Let's go to page 14. I mentioned that we invest in high coupon mortgages. If we were a $500 billion firm, we couldn't probably do this strategy. The amount of mortgages outstanding for these various high coupons are shown in this graph. The 5.5% coupon has $50 billion. For a firm our size, that's a lot. That's plenty. The 6% have $31 billion. And note that if an investor is receiving in 5.5% coupon, the borrower is paying 0.5% higher. So that means someone's paying 6%. There's $50 billion worth of mortgages where the borrower is paying 6%. Current mortgage rates are 3.5%. So the vast majority of the people that have these higher coupon mortgages have paid off. Oftentimes when we buy a pool of mortgages, you'll see 70, 80, maybe even 90% of the loans already gone. So we're buying them once all the people that are, you know, refinance or can refinance have, and you know, the rest of the loans, since they haven't paid off by now, there's a very low likelihood that they'll pay off going forward. And we love that because we want to keep that high coupon as long as possible. And on the next page, page 15, I want to kind of go through a little bit of the math of how it works. So in this case, we're buying $100,000 of a mortgage. And believe it or not, we actually do that sometimes. We'll buy a list that maybe there's 20 or 30 mortgages on it, and they'll range from, you know, $100,000 piece up to a $10 million piece. but we'll buy the whole block all at once. In this case, just for easy math, it's 100,000. It's a 6% coupon, so the borrower's paying 6.5. In order to get a 6% coupon in this marketplace, you have to pay up for it. So in this case, we have to pay $112,000 to get $100,000 worth of a mortgage. And what kind of keeps people away from this strategy sometimes is the fear of the scenario at the very bottom of the page. Well, let's say there were only two or three loans left in a pool, and for whatever reason, all of them paid off in 6 months. You got half a year's worth of interest, so you got $3,000, but you lost all $12,000 of that extra premium you had to pay. So you end up huge loss. It's a short duration government strategy. Your client fires you, your boss fires you. It's, you know, tears all around. And that does happen from time to time. But we have the law of large numbers on our side. We've got thousands of pools and tens of thousands of underlying mortgages. So the shaded area is more realistic. 20% or one-fifth of the people pay off for whatever reason. There could be a default, which just comes through as a prepayment from the government agency that guarantees it. Otherwise, it's, you know, people just move. There's death, there's divorce. Those are the main reasons. It's rarely due to someone suddenly waking up after all this time and realizing that they can get a lower rate mortgage. So a change in interest rates seems to have a very small impact on the prepayments for this particular group of mortgages. So in this case, you got most of your interest. You got $5,400 out of a maximum of $6,000. You did lose 20% of your premium, so 20% of $12,000 is $2,400. But you still ended up with a net profit, and so there's the yield there of 2.7. But this page is already outdated. We're closer to 1.8 or 1.9% right now on mortgages that we're buying. Now that's the theory. Page 16 shows you the reality. So if we could flip to the next page, the green line on this page represents our long-term history of prepayment activity in this strategy. And the vertical axis is capturing what percent of the people are paying off in any given year. So it's an annualized percent of people that are paying off. And it's been between this 10 and 20% range for a long, long time. We put the other lines on there for the more traditional mortgages to show you just how volatile it can be for a traditional mortgage strategy, where a small change in interest rates drastically changes what percentage of the people refinance. And we're focused on loans that are, you know, less than 100,000 a lot of times. Especially, we love loans that are like 50,000, because there it's clearly just not worth the hassle to refinance your mortgage. No offense to you all, but we can't stand California loans. The loans are so big. Everyone knows where mortgage rates are like every day. And that's not what we're looking for. We like states where there's a big fee to refinance, like there's a registration fee or some other mortgage tax. So places like Texas, Arizona, New York, Florida, those places, it's just really costly to refinance your mortgage. But there's a lot of states like Oklahoma, Missouri, Louisiana, Tennessee, you know, certain areas of the country where the loans are just very small. And it's nice to be able to get those loans. In Minnesota, everyone has like a cabin up north. And we love getting pools where maybe 25% of the pool might be second homes, because it is a real headache to refinance a loan on a second home. You have to jump through so many hoops, and it's, you know, the stack of documents you have to fill out. So it's great. And usually those loans aren't that big, and people are like, you know, they don't worry about it. So it's nice that we don't have to deal with that. Now, let's go to page 17.
Bryce, can I ask a question, please?
Yeah, please.
Back to 15, right at the top of the page. I'm not a math whiz, but I'm not really figuring this out. We got a coupon at 6%. Purchase cost is 112, par 100. premium paid is 12,000. I'm reading that as 12%. I don't understand the 6% versus the 12,000.
Oh, right. The price paid is a 12% premium. The coupon interest that the investor receives each year is going to be 6% of 100,000. So it seems crazy. It's like, well, why 12% if I'm only getting 6% interest? It'll take me 2 years worth of interest just to make up the extra premium. And that is true. But what we find is that we get 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years worth of that extra interest. And that more than makes up for the initial 12% that you had to pay.
Got it. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for the question. That's key.
If I could raise one other question. One thing I haven't heard or just haven't picked up on a lot of the news I've seen is that with the unemployment rate the way it is now, the number of people unemployed, there's certainly the sense in my mind that we should be either seeing or be prepared for a groundswell of mortgage defaults. Is there something that's out there that is just sort of the unknown that we might be seeing, or is there enough legislation out there that says the banks need to work with the people beforehand? I just don't see anything about where we are on mortgage
default. It's been so fluid. That's why it's been tough to kind of keep. You're right. It is tough to see anything on that. But I can tell you exactly what is going on. There are a large number of forbearance requests that have come through where people are allowed to have up to 3 months of not having to pay their mortgage payment. And there was an initial surge of a lot of those, but 40% of those people that requested forbearance have actually since been paying. They never actually skipped a payment. And that was kind of a surprise for people, but I think it's tied to how much money was distributed fiscally between the $1,200 per worker and the unemployment benefit that gave you the extra $600 a week on top of what you got anyway. Because even on rent payments outside of New York, it's amazing how many people are still paying their full rent. Our concern in these particular instances with mortgages for the investor, we were worried that, okay, once the forbearance period is over, they're not going to be able to pay those 3 months back. You know, how are the servicers going to cure that loan? The second option, if they couldn't pay it all back at once, was to spread it out over the next 12 months. So people aren't going to do that either. So the third option, what we were worried about, was that they have to take the mortgage out of the pool because now they're going to change the final maturity date. They're going to extend the maturity by 3 months. And that would cause a bunch of prepayments. And we were, you know, the whole mortgage market was like, oh man, how are we going to handle this? What's going to happen? And Fannie and Freddie and Ginnie Mae, and they all came up with a good solution, and thank goodness. And it says at the very end, at the normal maturity date, that's when those 3 months worth of payments will be due. And as you probably know, almost no mortgages make it all the way to the end. People move and turn over so much that it's rare that a 30-year mortgage ever makes it to the very end. So if they were to sell the house, those three payments will get paid at the time that they sell it. The additional advantage that we're on these really old mortgages is the people have a lot of equity built up in their house, so they're not missing any payments because they want to keep that equity. They don't want to lose that by losing their house to the bank. So that's another advantage to these more seasoned mortgage pools. The annual default rate, by the way, is less than 2% on these. It's really low. And it's consistently still done that even in this this turmoil that we've seen recently.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, you bet. Let's go to page, I think it's page 17. Is that where we were? Yeah. So the safety of this particular asset class is shown by the year-to-date 2020 return, which is the second set of bars from the right. The fact that they're government agency guaranteed allows this group of mortgages to really benefit from a flight to quality when the stock market goes down. And so it has a 3.8% year-to-date return versus 3% for the government index. You would think that treasuries, you know, would lead everything. And they have, for the most part, they've beat almost every bond asset class there is, other than probably this narrow slice of the bond market, which are these high coupon government mortgages. And so the additional role that this has played in your portfolio, and frankly plays in many of our clients' portfolios, is as that extra flexibility for being able to, you know, redeploy some of the money into other risk asset classes that have gone down. So it fits, you know, hearing Jim talk about that zone two flexibility built in to the liquidity portfolio, where you could have, you know, taken some of these, you know, sold them and allocated them into equities or something like that. This strategy does fill that role as well. And the annualized since inception is there, 3.6% versus the benchmark of 2.5%. Let's go to page 18. Well, first, before I go to Outlook, are there any questions on the performance or those mortgages? We can talk for hours about the mortgages. I'm sorry, we know so much detail about the borrowers.
Any trusted questions? Doesn't look like it. Please continue.
Okay. So here, let's go to page 19. It's all about the Fed. The Fed. It's unbelievable. We've never seen anything like this. If you go to page 20, you can see what the Fed funds rate has done. The two-year yield and the five-year yield have all collapsed to near zero. It's amazing in terms of how fast it has gone to zero. Let's go to page 21. And yet, our rates are higher than so many other countries. I mean, it's unbelievable. Look at all the red on this page. How many countries have their government bonds at negative yields, which is a terrible idea. It creates so much bizarre distortion in behavior and unintended consequences that kind of put countries into a box that they don't really know how to get out of. So I'm fine with rates at zero, but I think it's just a terrible, terrible idea to go negative. I mean, to charge your own banks fees to have cash, well, now they're not going to have cash, and now they're really, really risky. I mean, that's really not what you're trying to do as a central bank, you know, to put your financial system at as a precarious of a place as possible with the least amount of liquidity is just leads to other bad decisions that they've been making of having to push cash into the hands of people that shouldn't get it. Like companies that aren't making profits, they borrow at a negative rate in order for a bank to get rid of cash so they don't have to pay the central bank. I mean, just really distorted kind of behaviors come from that. So let's hope we don't ever get there. Let's go to page 22. Corporate yields have definitely not followed. They've come back a long ways. This is as of May. As of, you know, today, the corporate yields are down another 40 basis points or so, not quite 0.5%. And that's because the Fed has been trying to get some programs off the ground to really start buying corporate bonds, and they finally just started. But just the anticipation that they were going to do that as soon as they announced the programs did most of what you see right here in terms of bringing the yield of corporates down. Let's go to page 23. Most of what the Fed was buying, though, initially, which brought treasury rates down, was they were buying tons and tons of treasuries and tons of mortgages that they had already traditionally had the option to do. And so this skyrocketing increase of bonds that they have on their balance sheet, I guess it's called, you know, I just think it's bonds that they bought, is $7 trillion. And they just started all these other programs that allow them to buy municipal bonds, to buy high yield bonds, to buy corporate bonds, to buy just about anything but stocks. Let's go to page 24, and you can kind of get a sense of that.
Right. Having said that, you just said except for stocks, but yes. I had seen something recently that suggested that they're open to a discussion about holding equities.
Well, they actually provide equity in things like during the crisis, they took equity positions in banks.
Yeah, but I'm talking about actually buying stock.
I know, it almost becomes like a terminology. I'm like, oh, so you've always had this line in the sand that you're not going to buy stocks, but you've been investing in equity of all sorts of different companies and entities. Now, granted, it was primarily banks, but now recently some of these facilities actually provide different types of equity-like instruments. There were five airlines today that just signed agreements with the Treasury to do a deal where there's equity. And the Fed is financing the money that the Treasury is using. So to me, it's almost semantics. And like, if they suddenly decide that they're going to buy stocks outright, I think that's terrible. But they've already been doing something really similar to that on and off for quite a while now. And they just have tried to make it seem like it's not the same as buying stocks outright. But it's if it's not, it's a close cousin.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, though. I had sent out a little note or included it in one letter saying, you know, the two things I thought they'd never buy are stocks outright and high yield. And the next day they announced they're buying high yield. It's like, okay, so who knows what they do next. But here, this graph shows that the green bar is the maximum allowable money that they can spend in these different programs, like buying municipal bonds or buying asset-backed bonds. And then the little dashed line shows how much they've done. And it's the point of the page is to just say they have a lot of capacity to do a lot more if they need to. So it's essentially infinite amount of money that they can put into the bond market to prop it up. The reason for it is they just want to get as much cash into companies' hands so that the companies survive until there's a vaccine. So you look at the amount of money raised divided by the daily cash burn, and anyone that can last out 10 months from now, it's bizarre that the more companies are borrowing, the better their bonds are doing. Normally, as a bond manager, I'm like, hey, the more debt the company's taking on, the more likely they are to default. But in this world, it's like the more cash they're able to raise, either in the stock market or the bond market, and the vast majority of it's in the bond market, just a fraction of the money raised is in the equity market, and yet the equity issuance has still hit a record. In the bond market, there's been over $1 trillion raised by corporations this year. And so you've seen a lot of corporate bond spreads come in. And that's mainly just the investment grade universe. Because on the high yield side, you've seen a record amount of defaults. It's even past 2009. And so you've got this bifurcation that's going on. What the Fed's doing here is they just want to get rates as low as they possibly can to allow companies to raise as much money as they possibly can so they can survive until there's a vaccine. Let's go to page 25. Unemployment is terrible. It's come down slightly, but has a huge, long ways to go. Page 26. Small business optimism has actually ticked up a little bit. This is hopes that we'll be able to reopen safely. You know, some areas of the company are reopening safely, some are not, and there's no consistency. The town I'm in, we just passed, as of yesterday, we have to all wear masks because there's a sudden uptick in cases. 90% of young people going to grad parties, and they actually were able to like pinpoint that. You go to Wisconsin, it's because they opened the bars. You know, it seems like it's different for different areas. So it's going to be kind of this stop and start type of mode. One of my brothers owns, seven or 10 different temp agencies, different cities. And he said that his manufacturing clients it's killing them because they would have their workforce come in, one person gets sick, all of a sudden 10 people are out. And then their families are out of the workforce as well for 2 weeks. And this stop and start is making it almost impossible for them to stay in business for more than another few months. Let's go to the next page, page 27. This is my great hope that there's so much savings being built up. I mean, Americans basically spend everything they have, like 95% of what they have. And the savings rate rarely moves more than a couple percentage points. And here we're up to 33%, a third of disposable income is being saved. Once there is some sort of breakthrough in a vaccine, you'll initially see a huge, huge positive reaction in the stock and the bond market, followed maybe 3 to 6 months later by a huge boom in spending. I think there's a massive amount of pent-up demand to just do something, get out of the house, go anywhere, you know, go on a trip, whatever. And people actually have the money to do it. It's just stunning to look at this page. As far as treatments go, by September, we're going to have a really massively effective antibody cocktail that will help survivability. Was there a question?
Yeah, I was going to say, does that savings rate also reassure you with respect to people's ability to pay their mortgages?
It does.
That they've got that buffer.
It does. It does. My family's business is in real estate. I just talked to my mom, and there's 100% of the people have paid their rents. And that's not the 100% of the business, but and it's she's liquidating everything over a 10-year time frame, but it's still an indicator. It's just amazing to see how many mortgages are being paid, how many rents are being paid, how many car payments are being made, how many credit card payments are being made. I mean, you know, people are saying, oh, delinquencies are going up, but they're still all way, way less than we had initially feared. There's a steroid that helps people survive if they've been on a ventilator. There's the antiviral drug that's lessening the amount of time people are sick by 4 to 6 days. There's an anti-blood clotting drug that is a huge, huge lifesaver because the way the virus works, it causes all sorts of side issues, not by destroying your immune system. It's not just attacking the lungs. So a lot of people end up having to have a limb amputated, and then that leads to other things, and then they don't survive. So this anti-blood clotting thing is a big deal. So with those four main treatment issues, of which the fourth one really comes in a big way in September, we expect the fatality rate to drop from it's something over 4% right now to as low as maybe 2%. So that's going to be, we just gotta buckle down for another 3 months, without getting crazy. I wish everyone would just wear masks and do it. You know, South Korea does, and so many other countries that have really figured out will do. And if we can just do that, it'd be great. And then I expect a vaccine sometime between December and March. And there's eight that are in phase two or phase three testing today. And that doesn't count anything that China has. I've a gentleman that who works in the investment world in China. He lives in Hong Kong. His main focus is medical. He said there's 218 viral vaccine tests going on in China, and they already have 9 huge manufacturing plants ready to go. They're expecting a vaccine earlier because they've been working on it a lot longer than they would admit. Let's put it that way. We just got to get through the next few months, and I think there'll be hope that we'll come back into the bond market, they'll come back into the stock market, they'll come back into companies' hopes for survivability. We'll actually go back to valuing stocks based on future earnings. Right now, stocks have only bumped up just because they're looking at who has enough to survive their cash burn for X number of months. It's not because of future earnings projections. So I think there's going to be another leg up, you know, in 6 months when you see some of these lower fatality rates as well as hopes of a real vaccine come into play. That's all for my formal comments, but I'm happy to answer questions.
Anyone have a question for Bryce? Doesn't appear so. So thank you so much for this presentation. It was extremely helpful.
Yeah. Thank you for all your time. Appreciate it.
Okay. Take care.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.